owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Most of us, at least those of us over the age of 40, probably recall MASH, the long-running TV series about combat surgeons during the Korean War. Now, battlefield medicine has made great strides since then. The latest figure I could find, about 92% of our military wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan made it home alive. We've had guests on American Warrior Radio who are living, breathing examples of this fact. Mike Day, the Navy SEAL, shot 27 times in one engagement, and quadruple amputee Travis Mills come to mind. Today's show will maintain our focus on the men and women of our military, but we're going to explore an interesting tangent that impacts all of us. You're going to want to stick around for that. What does the war in Iraq have to do with the discussion of healthcare in the U.S.? Again, stick around. Our guest today believes that the truths of storytelling are universal. That's why fairy tales are told, why Jesus spoke in parables, and why he uses them. Their applicability is not limited to specific circumstances. He's an osteopathic doctor who specializes in dermatology and treatment of skin cancer. He also served 5 years in the United States Navy, the majority of which he spent as the battalion surgeon for the United States Marine Corps 1st Recon Battalion. Dr. Reagan Anderson, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
It's my privilege to be here. Thank you.
Can I just call you Doc and we'll be done with it?
You can call me Reagan if you want. I'm a normal guy just like everybody else.
Well, you know, I call you Reagan, people are start confusing your politics and your heritage, so we'll figure it out. It's just a friendly chat.
Sure.
Now, Reagan, when you were brought to my attention by our friends Ted Robertson and the gang up there at KRDO in Colorado Springs, I thought, oh, boy, you know, I saw your book title. And I thought, ah, here comes another socialist commie that Ted's trying to send me. But it's not at all that. And again, this is going to be a very interesting, maybe a different kind of chat than we normally have on American Warrior Radio. But your bona fides, you did serve in the military, as I mentioned. Now, I'm not going to go through the number of degrees you've got, Doc, because you must be a masochist. I don't know. It's like a whole page of time in school. But it's interesting to me. Among that list of degrees was a degree, a Master of Christian Studies, which translates into seminary school, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, I went to seminary prior to medical school. And for those listening, I lost my faith in Iraq, and I've been trying to rebuild it ever since. So full disclosure, I am a very confused ex-seminarian, if that's even a word.
Okay, I tell you, Doc, we're going to take an early, real quick break, so I want people need to hear this. So, folks, Ben Bueller Garcia and American Warrior Radio, we're talking with Dr. Reagan Anderson. While we're away, if you want to research ReaganBAnderson.com, stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Dr. Reagan Anderson. Dr. Anderson served 5 years in the U.S. Navy. And Doc, I want to clarify that because you would think a guy like me would know better, but you, 5 years in the Navy, but you spent your military career as a Marine surgeon. Now, does the Marine not have their own doctors? Explain to us how that works.
Correct. So the Marines don't like to admit this, but they are part of the Department of the Navy. So they might call it the men's department or whatever they want to call it. But they do not have their own medical, nor do they have their own clergy. So they pull those resources from the Navy. And if you want to be a doctor for Marines, you have to go Navy. And then you get embedded into the Marine battalions. You wear their uniform. You abide by their culture and their rules. And you serve that population. But technically, I was not a Marine. I was a Navy doctor assigned to a Marine battalion.
Now, why is that just tradition, or what is the rationale behind that? That's just the way it's always been?
The way it's always been, as far as I know.
Okay.
And, you know, the Marines are lean and mean, and, you know, the few, the proud, and there's not a lot of fluff among the Marine Corps. So I think that that's one of the reasons that they pull from the Department of the Navy, because the Department of the Navy does so well in these arenas.
Okay. Now, you're at medical school, and you tell a really, it made me kind of smile, a little story. You show up and your first day, or I don't know what it was, Doc, you're in the cafeteria and all these gals are kind of eyeballing you, and you're thinking, what's going on? And I've got a personal sort of, it struck me because my folks were missionaries. And in my high school year, we moved to a small town where, let's just say, our religion was not the majority religion. And there was a bonus on recruiting, apparently, the two sons of the new Protestant pastor in town. And so my first day at the community swimming pool, I had lots of girls who were, let's just say, above my class paying a lot of attention. I thought, hey, this is going to be okay. And then I found out there's a bounty on my head. You had a similar experience.
I did have a similar experience. So for some reason, when people go into medical school and when people become doctors, they're separated from normal society, and we're just treated differently, and different things are expected of us. So I was at a coffee shop in town, and some of the local girls were looking at a table of the medical students studying, and they were laughing and giggling and pointing. And I basically looked over and I said, guys, do you know what's going on here? And they said, yeah, they posted all of our pictures in the newspaper, and the girls are picking their mark. And it was such an interesting dichotomy because, prior to this, I had received not that type of attention from women. And after becoming a physician, it is interesting how society tries to idolize us. And I think that people tend to do that for a number of reasons, but one of which is not altogether helpful. And that is, a lot of people want to put all of their health into their physicians or their healthcare providers' hands. Mm-hmm. And so they think that they can eat what they want, drink what they want, smoke what they want, and have a lifetime of poor health choices, and then go into the physician and we're going to hand them a magic pill and snap our fingers, click our heels, and poof, they're going to be healthy. And that's not how it goes. We're people like everybody else.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, hold that thought, because that's a definite lead that I want to pursue later on in the show. Let's take care of your military bona fides first. And I got to tell you, again, when I first saw the title of your book, Universal Death Care, I thought, okay, this is not an appropriate, I don't say appropriate, but it's not the theme that we normally cover here on American Warrior Radio. And you probably get that from a lot of radio hosts initially until they read the book. And I got to tell you, Doc, you are, among other things, a great writer. I mean, you are a true storyteller. And one of the things that jumps out at me right off the bat, so you're Navy, you get assigned to this Marine battalion, but your initial, let's say, first contact with the rest of your battalion was not ideal, let's just say. I mean, take us, you're in an airplane, headed into a combat zone, and take it from there, sir.
Right. So I just finished dive school, and dive school is where they send the Navy physicians who are going to be taking care of the special communities within the armed services. And I was going to 1st Recon Battalion. Now, they're not technically special forces or special operations command. They were like the stepchildren of the special forces community, and everybody in the Marines knows what recon is and knew the very loose association we had for getting the worst assignments and all of those sorts of things. Well, I left dive school and I went to Iraq, had a combat landing, and I was carrying with me 6 combat parachutes, and it had to be secret because recon wanted to do the first combat jump since Vietnam, or at least the first official combat jump since Vietnam. And I was by myself because they were already in country. And so I was lugging these 6 parachutes plus my personal gear in the middle of a sandstorm after a combat landing, and I couldn't see more than 20 feet in front of me, 10 at the most. And I finally got to the hangar, and they were yelling and screaming for me because it took me a good 20, 30 minutes to get to that hangar. And they had another helicopter ready to lift me to Fallujah. And so I got some help, loaded the parachutes on, and then they dropped me off after being shot at multiple times on that helicopter ride. And Grant, I'm all by myself. Nobody else from the battalion is there. And I can't tell anybody what's inside the bags. And they dropped me off in the middle of a field in the middle of the night as a sandstorm was dying down, and throw the parachutes out of the helicopter. And one of the guys yells at me, walk that way, as the helicopter, you know, basically takes off. And so I turn around and I'm looking around, and then all the sand and the dust. And so you just kind of crouch down on the ground to protect yourself from all the flying debris. And while I was on the ground, I was thinking, which direction did he say to point in? I didn't know I was on a military base. I didn't know where I was. All I knew was I was in Fallujah and my battalion was somewhere. And so I freaked out. I mean, the taste of fear. I don't know if, Ben, if you've ever tasted fear, but it is all consuming. And so I reached for the weapon that was by my side, and I crouched down, and I gave myself the old college pep talk here that you can do it. And then I looked around as the dust was settling and as the sandstorm wasn't that bad at that point. And I sort of demised which way I should go by how I was standing and how the parachutes were placed around me from being thrown off of the helicopter. And I just hoped that I picked the right direction. Well, so one by one, I picked up the parachutes, moved them 10 feet, got the next one, moved them 10 feet, and headed in a direction that I thought was friendly territory.
And that, you know, it's interesting. When I mentioned you're such a great writer, that I literally wrote down that quote, fear has a flavor to it. Certainly, I've not experienced what you did, but that resonated with me as well. And so at the end of the day, you did find out that the reason those bags are so heavy is because they're parachutes, or did they have something else that we still can't talk about?
No, they were just parachutes, and I knew they were parachutes from day one. They told me that, but they told me I could never let them leave my side and couldn't tell anybody else and all that sort of thing. And they did do as far as I know, it was the first combat jump official since Vietnam, and we did do it, and I did support that mission. So
we've had a number of what I call warrior healers on the show before. Dr. Richard Carmona, who was the former Surgeon General. He was a combat medic with the he was a Green Beret in Vietnam. Dr. Josh Apple, he was the pararescueman on the famous Lone Survivor mission. So I find that the dichotomy very interesting, but we never had a battalion, you know, a combat surgeon on before. Describe to us, because you're give us a mental image of what it's like in a mass casualty event.
It's chaos. If you choose to turn it into controlled chaos, that's because of being cool, calm, and collected and being a leader. But it's chaos, and especially in a war setting. So picture yourself in a old concrete bunker that you might stumble across as you're going for a hike someday. And you see this old concrete bunker, and the walls are intact, and there's a concrete roof. But the paint is peeling off the walls. The floor is dirty and sandy and gritty and bugs. And that was Fallujah Surgical. And people can go online and type in Fallujah Surgical and look at the images, and you can see what I'm talking about. You're in a building that doesn't really have power, doesn't have running water, doesn't have any modern equipment. And you are tasked with treating some of the most horrendous traumas that you can even imagine. And your job is to stabilize them. Your job is to stabilize them to get them to the next echelon of care, or the next level of care, which would have been Baghdad for us. It's dusty, it's dirty, it's sweaty. Fallujah was under constant rocket and mortar fire during my first deployment. So anytime the rockets or mortars would land anywhere close to the building, sand and silt would fall from the ceiling onto the patients. Patients sometimes look like a powdered donut because of all the junk in the air. And you can't rely on any equipment. All you have is common sense and the grace of God. That's it.
That's tough. Well, yeah. Now, one thing, though, having said all that, Doc, you don't brag about this, but the fact of the matter is, during that time or your time deployed, every single person that came to you alive stayed alive. And I think that's a testament to you, and hopefully you'll go ahead and just accept credit for that and compliments for that. But that sort of leads us into one thing else that came out, the most shameful moment of your life that you feel, what you feel the most shamed for, what did take place there in Fallujah Surgical.
It did. And You know, when you said that I didn't lose anybody who came to me alive, I had a simultaneous burst of adrenaline through my body, shame and pride and guilt and all of it. It's such a complicated thing. I was very fortunate, to take care of those people. One day though, I turned my back on a patient who was very injured, and I was tired. I mean, the fatigue of war is overwhelming. And after a while, after so many days of not sleeping and not eating, and you just don't think right. And I had an Iraqi who was the most injured in this mass casualty scenario. And I didn't care enough about this human being to actually invest my time and skill into resuscitating him. I just wanted him to die so I could move on and treat the Marine who was 10 feet away, who was the next most injured, because my talents and my skills ought to go to the Marine. And I did a horrible job of resuscitating him. And I walked to, you always have to check out with another physician when you're about to pronounce somebody dead or not worth wasting resources on. And so I went to the other doctor and I told him I was stopping the resuscitation and moving on to other people. And this patient was cold. So one of the rules of medicine is you're not dead until you're warm and dead, meaning if your body temperature is so low, a lot of times it's just because everything is shutting down. And if you can warm them back up to, you know, a good 97, 98 degrees, the whole body kickstarts again, and it will take care of itself. And the doctor I was speaking with said, "Reagan, not dead until warm and dead." And I got mad and had a little temper tantrum and said, "He's not worth it. He's not going to make it." And he looked at me and had a few other choice words, which I won't repeat on the radio. And at that point, I just wanted to smack him, tell him to wake up, that we don't have enough resources. But he was right, Ben. He was right. I turned around and I actually put all of my talents and skills into resuscitating this man who had just shot the Marine who was 10 feet away. And within a minute or two, I forget the exact timeline, he bounced back. He was resuscitated. He went into surgery and he lived. It's my most shameful moment in life because I turned my back on a human in need, and that's not what a physician's supposed to be.
I tell you, both my producer and I are looking at each other and we're just shaking our heads. I mean, to me, that story encapsulates in one scene the ludicrous position that you're put in as both a warrior and a healer. And it makes me think, Dr. Carmona tells, well, he didn't tell a story. When he was on the SWAT team, he was actually going to a football game. There was some guy in the middle of the intersection who was off his, I don't know. Anyway, he's like shooting at people and threatening people. So Dr. Carmona actually had to shoot this guy to protect others and then immediately holstered his weapon and went over and then started trying to save his life. Those were his two duties. Just crazy stuff. Doctor, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your exit. Again, very powerful story about your exit from the combat zones and really what brought you to where we are now today talking about healthcare. Ladies and gentlemen, visit ReaganBAnderson.com or UniversalDeathCareBook.com. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia with Dr. Reagan Anderson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Dr. Reagan Anderson. When we last left our hero, he was performing surgery in the dust and muck in Fallujah. Doc, you mentioned you lost your faith, and I think that really my interpretation from reading your book is that you're not just talking about your theological faith. You were burned out, and you were broken. And I will say that from my perspective, given what you did, perfectly understandable. One of the things from your book, before we get into your book specifically, sir, just really struck me. You tell a story about when you were coming back from your very first deployment, and I can relate to this. I can't relate to being shot at generally, but the stench of death, and those of us, sir, who have experienced that, it's Some smells don't, they don't leave your nostrils. They imprint themselves upon your brain. And you had a fine how do you do when it came to that when you first, tell us about getting on that plane after coming out of the field.
Sure. So we were heading back to Camp Pendleton, and we were all lined up alphabetically to get into the airplane. And it had been probably 6 or 7 days going from Fallujah to where we were flying out of. And it was, you know, 100, 120 degrees. We were sitting on the tarmac, same set of clothes, dirty, dusty Iraq. And as I'm walking into the airplane, the first attractive woman who I had seen in months, and Recon Battalion doesn't have any women in their battalion. So the first attractive woman I had seen in months looked at me, and as I was walking past her, she ran to the bathroom crying uncontrollably and throwing up. And all the other flight attendants were laughing at her. That was her initiation. All the other flight attendants had huge globs of Vicks vapor rub underneath their nose so that they couldn't smell how bad we smelled. But it wasn't until years later, I didn't understand why she was crying uncontrollably. And then it hit me that, you know, what we had witnessed, who we had to be to survive in war, and the things we were asked to do had robbed us of our humanity temporarily. So the people who are walking into that plane, we were more savages than we were humans. And the stench that was coming off of our body was enough to make somebody throw up. It was hard. It was hard. And then I started to realize in the plane ride home, what was I coming back to, and who was I to come back to anything?
Well, you're changed forever. You have to be, right? I mean, that's the human brain just doesn't absorb that kind of stuff. And then even people I've talked to who are experts at compartmentalizing, man, it's just not that simple, I would guess.
It takes a while. And, you know, the parallel between that and healthcare currently in America, I'd like the people listening to ask themselves what the physicians, what the healthcare workers, the nurses, all these people, the janitors at hospitals, what they are going through with COVID right now. And try to do your part so that we can slow the spread. But what I was experiencing in Iraq and being exhausted and burnt out and all these things, a lot of our healthcare workers are experiencing that for the first time in America right now. And they're going to need a lot of help when this pandemic is over.
Well, Doc, let's talk about that, because that's a really good transition. One of the things that really sent a chill down my spine reading your book, Universal Death Care, was you said that your first day of medical school, they get up there and tell you 50% of what we're teaching you is completely wrong. That doesn't exactly fill me with confidence, but I'll tell you, personally experienced it. My wife is going in for ACL surgery, major. I mean, she completely tore it. They're going to be cutting on her. But the first surgeon and pain management person they put us in touch with just did not, I mean, we didn't feel comfortable with them at all. So much so we postponed the surgery until we could, shop around is not the right word, but until we could find a doctor, surgeon, and a pain management person that she felt comfortable with and could trust. And much of that speaks to what I took away, sir, from the heart of your book, in that when it comes to healthcare, you mentioned before, we spend our entire lives destroying our bodies and then show up to someone like you and expect you to give us a pill and everything will be just be hunky-dory.
Yeah, it's not how it works. You know, in Iraq or in Afghanistan, the minority of people sent home were from battle injuries. So 18% of people medevaced back to America were from battle injuries from Iraq, and 24% from Afghanistan. Most of us think that when you're medevaced back from war, you're medevaced back because you're shot or blown up or something. But that's a small, small percentage. It's, you know, 18, 25%. And in America, most people think that disease just happens to people. And that's not how it is. We are the masters of our destiny the vast majority of the time, unless you get hit by a car or some crazy accident. And that is what is plaguing our healthcare system, is people not taking care of themselves. The vast majority of disease, the vast majority of money spent on healthcare in America is completely preventable if we would just eat well, exercise, and take care of our mental well-being. And the message of this whole book is that our system is collapsing because we can't be under the weight of everybody being entitled and taking resources from others and imposing their will on others. We can't. The system's collapsing. The only way is if all of us take personal and collective responsibility for our health and eat a carrot every once in a while. It's not that hard.
I do it regularly, sir. I want to be very clear about that. And I am not the poster boy for good, clean, healthy living, but I'm trying, Doc. I'm trying as hard as I can, particularly after reading your book. I need to try a little bit harder. But really, that's in the data. I'm a business guy, and you know, I've heard you say before, doctors just love statistics. And I tell you, I'm getting ahead of myself because now I'm getting fired up. You got me fired up. How on earth does the most wealthy, most perhaps technically advanced nation on the planet, how do people go without healthcare? I don't get how we got from point A to point B or point A to point F, wherever we are now, sir.
Well, I do.
Okay.
It's because people think that their individual freedoms are more important than somebody else's freedoms. And we've taken it too far. We've let the pendulum go too far. In other words, I can smoke and I can drink and I can be all these horrible habits and it's fine. It's my choice. And that's partially true, but people need to pay their fair share. See, in America, we've taken freedom and we've made it into what it was not intended to be. Freedom is supposed to be about me choosing my life and heading in that direction. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. But that does not give any of us the right to impose our will on somebody else and take from them. Well, and that's what we're doing. If we impose our will on other people by being so unhealthy that we're going to amass huge medical bills that are going to be on the government dime when we turn to Medicare age, and because of our selfish choices, that does not allow other people to get health care, that's not personal freedom in the way that this country was founded. That's just selfishness.
And my interpretation of your words there, Doctor, is also it's with that freedom and with that liberty, there does come responsibilities. It's not a blank check. I mean, there are trade-offs in everything in the universe. I mean, literally there's theories of physics that talk about that. But so you're putting that in the context of healthcare. And as a business person, what struck me is, well, two things. One, I think you said, sir, 85% of our expenses are spent on preventable diseases, but they didn't teach that in medical school.
No, between 50 and 85% of all healthcare dollars in America are spent treating things that could have been prevented had we lived healthfully. You know, Warren Buffett says, and I had to look this up so I get it correctly, and most people know who Warren is and respect him. He says, quote unquote, medical costs are the tapeworm of American economic competitiveness. And so what we have done is we've allowed our personal selfishness disguised as personal freedom to bankrupt an entire industry, which is hurting our competitiveness, our business economic competitiveness in the world for this. And medical schools, elementary schools, high schools, nobody is teaching how to eat a well-balanced diet, how to take care of ourselves. We have to get back to the basics of being educated. And I'm not talking about educated from big, big companies that are making all this ultra-processed foods that are killing ourselves. So I know statistics and doctors and they're boring, but they did a study last year where that if you consume more than 4 ultra-processed foods a day, now, these are things like frozen pizzas, hot dogs, energy drinks, soda pop. So more 4 servings of those a day, which is what the standard American diet is. You have an increased risk of dying from all causes by 62%. And that's our diet. Ben, it has to stop. We have to start looking at how we can live up to our potential. And the only way we can live up to our potential is if we're healthy.
What about the mocha fracha light latte with an extra cup of cream that people are drinking 6 of? I'm guessing that would fall in that category?
It definitely would. You know, a lot of those things, which unfortunately are pretty common, a lot of those are more, just drinking one of those drinks, that consumes more of your daily requirement of calories just in that one drink, and it gives you no nutritional value.
Okay, so now you're depressing me, Doc.
But well, listen,
personal responsibility.
There's a place for all things. If it's your birthday and you want to have one of those sugar, chocolate, cocoa bomb drinks, do it. But it's not every day, and it's not three times a day. We have to start being reasonable about these things.
Doctor, when we come back, I want to pursue that line as well, because we always want to give people solutions rather than problems. You mentioned statistics. I'm a business guy, and to me, you look for indicators in the economy and in the market. To me, one of the things that really stands out, last year, the medical tourism market was estimated at $44.8 billion, growing at 20% for a decade. People can save 60% off their cost by going to Thailand and enjoy some wonderful views while they're there, but they can't afford it here in their own country. We're going to pursue this idea more with Dr. Regan Anderson when we come back, folks. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Dr. Regan Anderson. Dr. Regan was a battlefield surgeon for 5 years, Navy, attached to the Marine Corps. And I'm sure, Doc, I'll be getting lots of texts and email messages from my friends in the Marines about, clarifying it is the men's department. But maybe we'll hear which flavor of crayon tastes best, too.
Well, yes, I'll reserve comments on the second.
That's with much love to my devil dog friends. Dr. Regan, we're talking a little bit about, now I really want to talk a lot about your book, Universal Death Care. And folks can find out more at universaldeathcarebook.com or visit reaganbanderson.com. The cover of the book and the title is a little bit off-putting, but I decided to read it because if Ted Robertson says it's good, it's good. And really, sir, this is not a partisan or a political issue. This is it's a human issue. And I almost don't even know where to start. But let me throw something out there while I've got your expertise here. Why on earth are pharmaceuticals in the United States of America so expensive?
Because you get what you tolerate. End of story. So in 2003, the Medicare Modernization Act was signed, and the pharmaceutical industry was able to negotiate with the lawmakers to say that we can't price negotiate drugs. Any government program can't, whatever the pharmaceutical industry wants to charge, that's what they have to pay. It blows my mind. And because of that, the pharmaceutical industry has decided that as long as they don't increase their prices more than 10% a year, that it's appropriate. 10% a year. Now, you're a businessman. If you get 10% and it's compounded, basically the cost of pharmaceuticals is doubling every 7 or 8 years. And yet we all know that the further out you are from research and development, the less and less something costs. So look, I am all about profit. I mean, I Ayn Rand is my favorite author of all times. And I'm all about corporate profit, but I am not about corporate profit to the point of people dying from their greed. There is a difference between those two.
Well, just so people know, I mean, you have your own clinic. You're a physician, but you're also a businessman. You see this. You sign the front end of the check, is another way to put it. So that, I tell you, one of the reasons this is such a sensitive subject for me is I am in that entrepreneurial category where there was a period in my life because of changes in healthcare where we didn't have insurance at all. I couldn't afford it. I just couldn't. And so I took the risk, and I don't know, maybe broke the law, who knows. But so we were cash pay, and it was fascinating to me, Doc, how in going into my optometrist, or not meds, but just talking to other physicians, and when they found out I was cash pay, it's almost like, oh, it was less expensive. I don't know why. It's like, okay, well, you know.
It's why, because about one third of all medical costs in America are spent dealing with administrative hassles and burdens put on us by insurance. So when you go to your doctor, when you go to me and you say, hey, I'll pay you cash, I'm going to give you a huge discount because I'm going to charge you a service And you're going to say, okay, it costs $10. Here's $10. And everybody walks away. If I bill insurance, I have to charge $30 to insurance, spend an enormous amount of time and effort trying to get them to pay. And after me spending $15 of employee time, I might get paid $13. It's insane. It costs us $6 billion with a B dollars a year just fighting with insurance companies for them to fulfill their contracts with providers and patients. $6 billion.
Let's talk about simple solutions, though, because one of the things that was interesting to me is when you're cash pay, I actually know what something costs. And yeah, I go to buy a car. Yeah, there might be a little haggling going on, but at the end of the day, we know what the price is for the car and what I paid for it before I drove it off the lot. But that doesn't apply to medicine, apparently.
Nope, it doesn't at all.
Can we just get a law to say you have to disclose the cost, period, end of story?
Well, that's part of it, but this is an essential service. So, Ben, imagine you broke your arm and you're going to drive to the nearest ER. You're not going to spend 3 hours shopping on which ER has the best price for a broken arm.
Right.
So it's different here. And people think that we have a free market in America. We don't. It's like going to the grocery store for a gallon of milk and you go to pay for it and you hand them money. They're like, oh, we're not going to take your money. Well, how much do I owe? Well, I don't know. It could be nothing. It could be $20. We'll let you know in 3 months. The solution that would save over $20 billion with a B dollars a year would be to have one set of rules and one set of prices. In other words, you need this procedure. These are the rules under which you can have it. And of course, if there's something that's different that has to, you know, go around the back end, you can appeal. But one set of rules, and this is the price. End of story. $20 billion. That's enough money to insure every citizen in this country and have them pay zero copay and zero deductibles and have more money left over for elderly services. But we won't do it. You know, John McCain was one of my heroes. Mm-hmm. He'll always be a hero of mine. And a hero for, he wasn't perfect, none of us are, but for so many reasons. But he put country first. When they were trying to repeal Obamacare, he did the infamous emperor's thumbs down. And from interviews that I've read later, his reasoning was we didn't have a replacement for it. You can't just abolish something that millions, over 20 million people rely on, 135 million with pre-existing conditions rely on. You can't just turn it down without a solution to replace it. He understood that we don't have a free market right now. What we have is an oligarchy. And the patient has no say in this. You either get your arm broken or you live with the consequences or you die.
Now,
that's not free.
I mentioned specifically the medical tourism. Laura and I saw a documentary about that in Thailand. And I am at that age where I now need to go get a certain procedure that men might find a little discomforting. But in Thailand, apparently, rather than that procedure, they give you a little capsule and you swallow it and go on about your day and come back. And that little capsule is going through your intestinal tract. And at the end of the day, they use that to and I'm thinking, why can't we do that here in the United States?
Well, we can, and that will come. I'm not a GI doctor, so the colonoscopies, I've been looking into this because I didn't say that's what it was. Oh, okay. but I'm nearing the age when I will need a colonoscopy, so I've been hopeful that I can swallow a pill rather than the other plumbing routine. But a lot of this comes down to money. It really does. I can't, as a dermatologist, I mean, skin cancers, there's an epidemic of skin cancer in this country right now. Mm-hmm. I can't look at something and say, you know what, I'm 99% sure that's a basal cell cancer. We're just going to take you to surgery. I can't do it. Our medical legal thing makes me do a biopsy, send it to the pathologist, get the report, and charge an extra $200 for that because there's no protections for providers. And the whole system from start to finish, we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater and replace it with personal responsibility, corporate responsibility, government responsibility, and accountability for all.
Doc, we're running out of time here. We've got just a couple of minutes, but I specifically want to bring up, because I like to give people solutions as well. I heard another interview where you're talking about package inserts and consent forms. Is that could you explain that to us as consumers, as patients? What that's a little thing or a big thing we can do to take more responsibility for our own healthcare?
Absolutely. So when you have a procedure done, there's a consent form. Read it. Understand it. Know how to prepare for the procedure. Know what you need to do before, during, and after. Be an active participant in your healthcare. Don't just go to the doctor and they hand you something and you sign it and you have no idea. That's when problems happen. I don't like being a dictator to my patients. I like partners as patients. But that requires people to care enough to do a little research before. And with this crazy advent of this little thing called the internet, it's at our fingertips. Everybody listening to this, just take some responsibility. Take 10 minutes. Whether you're getting a new prescription, read the package insert so you know what the complications could be. Just be a participant. Don't go to your doctor asking them to wave the magic wand and you abdicate all personal responsibility. It just doesn't work well.
And I tell you, sir, Ben gets a dumb question every show. I waited till the last to bring this up because I am so impressed with how smart you are. Please, doctor, tell us the connection between COVID and toilet paper.
It's fear. It's fear. Like, listen, the best thing that people can do right now is to be as healthy as possible. Yes, wear a mask and yes, social distance and all that stuff, but be as healthy as possible. Eat well, exercise, take care of your brain. If you do that and you get sick, chances are that COVID's just going to be an inconvenience. People would rather go and buy a bunch of toilet paper and then go and have their fast fried food instead of getting the vegetables and taking care of themselves.
Yeah, taking some vitamin D and zinc, maybe.
Vitamin D is huge, everybody. Yes, and some zinc. You know, when this whole thing started, I'm in Colorado, and I think our governor did an overall good job, but alcohol and marijuana stores remained open, and medical all shut down. Well, alcohol depletes zinc, so people are drinking in record numbers. Suicides, depression, all of that is in record numbers right now. So we're leaving stores open that are depleting zinc. Zinc is one of the main things that keeps you healthy. It's so backwards.
Science is hard.
So backwards.
Dr. Regan Anderson, thank you so much for spending time with us, folks. Visit ReaganBAnderson.com, UniversalDeathCareBook.com. Again, doctor, sorry we ran out of time, but really appreciate it. I hope, folks, that you need to read this book, folks. You'll learn a lot. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com for all our podcasts. All policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care of yourself, please.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.